the most interesting part of the entire story, is the persona that was made up for Lee Harvey Oswald. In other words, this was a long time preparation for what happened. I mean, here's a young man, he's in the military in Japan, and he learns to speak Russian, and then, of course, he gets out of the military, and he goes over to Russia. And everything is done to make him to appear to be pro-communist. And I'm sure you've heard the interview that that he gave to a radio station sometime there in I guess it was where it was New Orleans or something
yeah.
like that.
He was a Marxist, but not a communist.
If you listen to that interview, at one point they said, "Well, you wanted to defect to the Soviet Union." You know, you were pro-communist, something like that. And his remark was, no, I was always in contact with the American embassy. And he started to say, under the control of, but he didn't ever
yeah.
quite got it out. And that
yeah.
I was always in contact with.
Yeah.
And it would appear, you know, the Russians thought he was an American spy.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think he probably was an American
yeah.
spy. Is
yeah.
that your take on it?
Yeah. Yes, there's a wonderful book by a fellow named Philip Melanson entitled Spy Saga that traces Oswald's connections with intelligence agencies and is really a masterpiece. Other books that deal with his relations with the CIA, of course, include Mark Lane's book Plausible Denial and others, including one I'd mentioned that's quite valuable on the whole case entitled JFK versus CIA. By a guy named Michael Calder, that is a really wonderful overview and includes discussion of some of those financial interests that were desirous of getting rid of Jack and replacing him with LBJ. But the points you're making about Oswald are absolutely correct. Now, I was used to supervise recruit training at the same recruit depot in San Diego in the same rifle range, Edson Range at Camp Pendleton, where he took his training. Oswald was not trained to use a Mannlicher or Carcano, which is a bolt-action, single-shot weapon, but rather he was trained with an M1, which, of course, is semi-automatic, so every time you squeeze the trigger, you get a new round automatically ejected. He wasn't trained to use a telescopic sight. He wasn't trained to fire down from a building. Plus, he was a terrible shot. I mean, this is a guy whose best work at the rifle range was when he was a recruit. And, of course, that's not surprising because it's a time of intense training. But that was in 1957 when he shot a 212. In 1958, you're supposed to qualify every year. Apparently, he didn't qualify at all. And in 1959, just 2 years later, he barely qualified with a 191. Now, you got to shoot at least 190 out of 250, Stan, in order to be qualified. And, in fact, the pits are usually pretty forgiving so that if they see that you're really close to getting close, they may, you know, make a hole in the target for your benefit so that you actually qualify. There's no reason whatsoever to suppose that Oswald, even if he had a decent weapon, was capable of the performance that is attributed to him in Dealey Plaza. Plus, he became fluent in Russian in the Marine Corps. Now, they were calling him Oswaldovich. Well, I can assure you that you know everything there is to know about your men, and if this guy was studying Russian, it's because the Marine Corps, or I surmise the Office of Naval Intelligence, wanted him to do so. I mean, one remark that's been made, supposed to be derisive about Oswald's command of Russian, was that he only got 50% of the questions right on a Russian exam he took. Well, it turns out Russian is one of the most difficult languages to master. And to say he only got 50% right is in seeking to imply that he didn't know much about Russian is as ridiculous as to say you only got 50% of your calculus questions right. I mean, it's of that level of intricacy. Plus, of course, he was stationed at the most secure base in the United States military arsenal at Atsugi, which was the source of the overflights by the U-2. The Russians knew these planes were flying over and spying on them, but they didn't know the altitude, and they weren't able to shoot them down, and they were too embarrassed to admit that they knew it. Oswald, as a radar operator, appears to have had information about those altitudes, and it's widely speculated, and I believe it's true, that when he defected, and it was a pseudo-defection performed on a Sunday when the embassy was closed, so it had no legal significance, that he actually was bringing the Russians information about the altitude so they could shoot down the U-2, and lo and behold, what happens after his defection? But Eisenhower and Khrushchev are scheduled to have a summit meeting that's going to decrease world tensions. It's going to put a frost on the, you know, it's going to thaw the Cold War significantly. But the U-2 was shot down, and Khrushchev has to abort the summit meeting with Eisenhower, and Cold War tensions are increased rather than decreased. It looks as though that was information that Oswald was taking to the Soviet Union at the behest of his handlers. And, of course, when he comes back to the United States, he's not treated as though he were a traitor to this country. He's actually given money by a front organization, and he winds up down in New Orleans, and he's working for agencies that are appear to be fronts for the CIA, and he's adopting this persona, a form of sheep dipping, where he's given this artificial personality as an a pro-Castro communist, but everyone he's associating with is anti-Castro and is anti-communist,
and all
that. As well portrayed in the film JFK, Stan, I know you're aware of a lot of these things, probably all of them, but the fact is that everything we know about Oswald indicates he was working for American intelligence, and in fact, after the assassination, Wagoner Carr, who was the Attorney General of the state of Texas, launched his own investigation and discovered that Oswald had been working as an informant for the FBI since 1992, that he had informant number 179, and he was being paid $200 a month right up to the time of the assassination.
And, of course, you know, here he's actually passing out flyers for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and there were all these stories that just before the assassination, he goes down to the Russian embassy in Cuba, and he's trying to get the permission to go into Fidel Castro's Cuba. And all of this is a cover story, an elaborate, long time. I mean, you're talking about years and years and years to give the impression that he is pro-communist.
Well, several things about that Mexican trip, which, by the way, I don't believe Oswald ever made. The photographs that the CIA claimed to have turned out not to be of him, but looked very much like a fellow named Jim Hicks, who's actually photographed in Dealey Plaza with an antenna hanging out the back of his trousers and claims to have been the communication coordinator for the assassination. They had his voice allegedly recorded, but it wasn't the voice of Lee Oswald. And even J. Edgar Hoover disseminated a memorandum from FBI headquarters saying that somebody appeared to be impersonating Lee Oswald down in Mexico City. So, I mean, you know, anyone who says this was a lone, demented assassin has a huge number of problems to cope with just with regard to the Mexico City trip where someone was impersonating Oswald. And it wasn't the first and it wasn't the last time it happened.
And, of course, that to me, this is a long time, elaborate effort to give the impression that we have somebody who's not what they are. It's sort of like my friend Craig Roberts, who refers to Lee Harvey McVeigh, and
yeah,
everything that McVeigh did was to convince people to create this persona of an anti-government individual who, of course, the lone bomber and the Murrah Building, and
yeah,
of course he did this because of Waco. And but if you go into his background, you find out, of course, he has some strong ties to the special forces. In fact, he'd even written a letter to his sister saying he was in the special forces in a unit that was involved in criminal activity, and no less an authority than Gore Vidal has written that up in the September Vanity Fair. I get it, read it, understand that once in a while you will find the truth out there. Now, of course, what happened at Oklahoma City has sort of paled into insignificance with what happened on September 11th. But maybe if we'd learned the truth about Oklahoma City, we would not have seen what happened on September
11th. Maybe if we learned the truth about JFK, we wouldn't allow ourselves to be led around by the nose by a government too, Stan. You know, I think you're right on all counts. I mean, I'm no expert on Oklahoma City, but certainly it's fascinating to compare the amount of rubble that was left there. That was a real solid concrete structure, reinforced steel structure, with the Twin Towers. In fact, there's a very disturbing report, Stan. This is somewhat to one side, but it indicates that an architect from Australia has said that the towers collapsed because of cheap, poor construction, that they were not using, concrete, but they were substituting plaster, for example. And I really was struck by how little rubble there was that remained from these 110-story structures. I mean, there was very little there when it was all said and done compared to the Muir Building, where there was a huge amount of rubble. So I'm just saying that there's another side issue here as to whether or not the local, the Port Authority in New York City was doing its job in supervising the construction of that building. Of course, that's typical American way, cut corners to make a buck. It just may have been exposed here. And when the terrorists hit the Twin Towers, they may not have realized what a bonanza they were going to reap when the intense heat from the fire for the burning of the jet fuel caused the the steel beams to melt like spaghetti, this guy describes them.
Well, anyway, one day maybe we'll have more information, but the whole cover-up there, and of course, certainly everything would suggest that the CIA was involved, but the FBI had to be involved as well. Would you take your take?
In which case, Dan?
I'm talking about now the assassination of Kennedy. And
absolutely. Oh, yeah. Hoover clearly cleaned it up. I mean, he was covering it. The FBI was, concluded. He concluded the day of the assassination there had been a lone assassin and three bullets had been fired. Hoover actually claimed the first had hit Jack, the second had hit Big John, and the third had hit Jack. It was an opinion he never changed. Actually, the Secret Service maintained the same theory. So they never bought that one of the shots missed. Of course, one of the shots did have to miss. They never really accounted for that. So the government was actually holding several different positions at one and the same time. According to Warren Commission, of course, while they claimed or admitted eventually that one of the shots missed, they never decided whether it had been the first, the second, or the third. Ludicrous aspect of this whole thing, Stan. You know, Oswald was never claimed to have had more than four rounds. Can you imagine anyone going in to assassinate a president of the United States and all you take along with you is four bullets? You'd have to have an awful lot of confidence in your ability. Plus, you'd have to presume you didn't need your weapon in order to shoot your way out. If the police had actually been doing their job and closed in on you, how are you going to defend yourself? So, I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous. And the bullets themselves appear to have been planted just as the weapon that was alleged to have been Oswald seems to have been arranged in advance to create a paper trail that led to him.
Why did Oswald kill the police officer? I never could quite figure that out.
Well, Stan, I don't think he did. He killed the police officer either. There was a woman named Aquila Clemens across the street who said two persons had been involved in the shooting of Officer Tippett, which is very consistent with the shell casings that were found at the time. In fact, these were casings that were ejected from an automatic. Oswald only had a revolver. Can you imagine anyone shooting a police officer? He was shot three times in the torso, and then when he was lying on the ground, he was shot in the head by a shot that coincidentally entered his right temple. And then taking the rounds out of your chamber? I mean, it's ludicrous to think that Oswald would have done that, but he had to have done that in order for the shell casings to be present at the scene. And in fact, not only were they automatic shells, which immediately excludes Oswald as having shot Tippett, but they were of two different manufacturers. And the original was something like two of one manufacturer and two of the other, but later a substitution was made of revolver rounds. They didn't have the initials of the officer who had initialed the rounds discovered on the scene, and of course they were no longer automatic shell casings, but from a revolver lacking his initials, and now there were three of one kind and one of the other. There's an excellent discussion of all of this in Robert Grodin's book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, which is just a terrific book. As I mentioned before, Murder in Dealey Plaza, my new book, and his book, a classic collection of photographs, The Killing of a President, are now on a bargain package from Amazon.com at a third off of their usual price, so you can get a great package there. Anyone who wants to get into two of the best books ever on the assassination might want to go to Amazon.com and check it out.
All right, fine. And give that title just one more time.
Right, it's Murder in Dealey Plaza and The Killing of a President by Robert Grodin, which is just a really impressive collection of the most important photographs in the assassination of Jack Kennedy.
All right, fine. So if you're out there in the listening audience now and you have some questions or comments, why, we'll open up for calls here at 464-8295. Or if you're out across America, why, you can call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and I see the lights are beginning to light up already. But, you know, there is just so much here that, you know, but the incredible thing is the American people have accepted this through the years, or they've simply shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, well, that's past history. I don't want to be bothered.
Well, you know, Stan, I think that the American people have been pretty consistently skeptical about what the government told them. What they have not known is what they ought to believe in its place. So they haven't believed the government told us the whole story, but they haven't known what they should believe in its place. And I think here that the work to which that I've published with these best contributors working on these different areas helps to answer those questions.
All right, we've got Mike on the line here. Mike, did you have a question or comment?
A little of both.
Okay.
Last hour, Mr. Futzer was talking about the unusual parade route.
Yes.
Through the city, and that was coordinated by the mayor, did you say?
Well, I was suggesting that the mayor, insofar as he supervised ceremonial activities, including parade routes, would almost certainly have had to approve it. Actually, Jesse Curry, the chief of police, said that the final decision on the parade route, or the decision on the final parade route, was made by representatives of the police department and the Secret Service.
Okay. Something peculiar about the parade route, well, actually the assassination site,
yeah,
Dealey Plaza, being in the shape of a pyramid with the capstone cut off.
And, well, you know,
all around the area on the significant buildings is Freemason symbology.
Well, you know, that may be true. I'm not a student of that aspect of the symbolism. I know others, including Robert Morningstar of New York City, who have spent a lot of time on aspects like that. But that symbolism aspect, I mean, I can tell you that, it appears to have been the mafia, the CIA, and military intelligence that took Jack out. And I haven't myself found much of a role for Freemasonry, but I'm not telling you it's completely out of the question. For example, there are symbols on the police officers who are shown in the photographs escorting the tramps through Dealey Plaza. There's a funny kind of little white cross on their sleeve that has been suggested by Morningstar. It was some such symbol. So I'm not suggesting there's nothing to what you're saying. I'm saying we got a huge amount of evidence, you know, that implicates the CIA, the mafia, and military intelligence in taking Jack out, even without it.
And it may have been all of them together, Mike. We just, the time alone is going to tell. Three of the members of the Warren Commission were Masons, as was our inspector. But, that is simply another aspect, but I don't think there's any question at all that the CIA was involved in this. And, of course, that the mafia was involved in this. And,
yes,
and certainly the FBI knew what was going on. Hoover knew what was going on because he hated the Kennedys. And, of course, that embarrassed him because he had a deal with the mafia that he would never investigate them. And when the Kennedys came in, they insisted he begin. And that was very embarrassing for him. But that's another subject for another time. Anything else, Mike?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, let's go to Sonny calling from Aptos. And, again, our number 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Sonny, do you have a question or comment?
A comment. First of all, to thank you for your guest for his audacity to be able to think and realize that he is a free man and that it's a need for us to know on our own and to, and as I quote, is, for thine own self be true and know thyself. Now, Doctor, I've been listening to you since about, I think, 1969 or 70, when you were the only program on a talk show, and you went off at night, and you went off with your music and your sincerity, and I was happy and proud to be an American, but there was something I wasn't quite sure of. I was not quite sure if you were really aware of what was going on and how different groups of people were being used to cover things that the government was doing by having a focus group. It was either the communists, it was the blacks, it was the people who were trying to do this while all of this stuff was happening to us. And for me, to hear you admit that you had been taken, oh my Lord, I am such a happy man. My mind is free to know that, yes, if I know, it is because I know, and it is because God has given me the right and the ability to know, and patience and patience and patience, but not to give up what we know is true. We're being had in such a big time way, and all we have to do is listen to what they say they're going to do to other people. Hell, they give us a diagram of what they're going to do to us.
Well, it's about time we just get things out, and please get other people listening to our program.
Oh, I most certainly will, and
God bless
I'm
you.
So happy. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, a long-time listener, that first-time caller. I've never talked to Sonny before, but I'm glad he's out there listening. And we had a lot of people listening who never call in, and that's the sort of exciting thing about doing talk radio is 5 hours a day like we do. Well, there's so many different manifestations of this, and really, of course, the successive, you know, commissions that they set up. They had, of course, the Warren Commission, and then they had, what, two or three other commissions there. There were
yes.
all these sort of whitewash, anything to keep the American people from being able to see the clarity. I mean, all you have to do is look at the magic bullet. You know it's all alive.
Yes. Well, one of the most important features of our work is that our discoveries provide a basis for excluding certain hypotheses. For example, the thesis that the Mafia did it alone. The Mafia, no doubt, was involved, as we agree, but the Mafia could not have extended its reach into Bethesda Naval Hospital to fabricate the autopsy report or to create x-rays that concealed wounds rather than revealed them. Neither pro nor anti-Castro Cubans could have substituted diagrams and photographs of someone else's brain for that of Jack Kennedy. In fact, it turns out, Stan, that we now know there were two different brain examinations that were conducted by the pathologist after the assassination. One apparently on Monday, actually with Jack's brain, but another a week later that brought over this pathologist from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, who actually was the only one of the three who had any experience with gunshot victims. Apparently, in order to take him in by a bait and switch into assuming that this substitute brain, which didn't show anything like the kind of damage that had been sustained by Jack Kennedy's brain, was the real brain. He, I think, was rather skeptical about that, but we now know from work done by the Assassination Records Review Board, which has declassified some 60,000 documents and records that had been held secret up until now, there actually were these two different brain examinations. Where the second was being used as though it had been the first to create the fraud, perpetrate the fraud of substituting the brain for the original. And, of course, the reason that had to be done, Stan, is this. Once you patched up that massive blowout to the back of the head caused by shot from in front, you had to reconstitute the brain because there was nowhere for all that missing brain tissue to go. Plus, in the case of the Zapruder film having been massively edited, while the KGB may have had the ability, like our CIA, to extensively fabricate a motion picture, they had no way to get their hands on it. So the exclusion, the way in which the cover-up was executed allows us to exclude a lot of hypotheses about who was responsible. It can't have been the KGB. It can't have been pro- or anti-Castro Cuban, certainly not on their own, though there may have been some involvement there, and I certainly think they had something to do with the fuse that ignited the whole business through the CIA and their efforts to take Castro out. And it can't have been the Mafia all on its own. Nor, of course, could any of these things have been done by Lee Oswald, who was either incarcerated or already dead.
Well, of course, there's so many cover stories. There's one of them, there's a gentleman who's in jail and for shooting a police officer, I think it was, highway patrolman. And there's a video that circulated. We bought a copy of it. And he says, I was one of the three Mafia assassins. Are you acquainted with that?
Oh, story? Yeah, you're talking about the Files. Guy, James Files, who claimed he was one of the assassins.
Right.
Now, I've looked at that film a couple of times for a local TV station, and my reaction was that it's about 80%. I give it an 80% accuracy rating, meaning about 80% of the things he has to say about the assassination are true. But there's about 20% of what he says that is not true. He talks about having been sort of casually worked into the assassination, having come down there with a guy named Chucky Nicoletti, who was a major mobster and might have had a role in assassinating Jack. But the way in which he was asked to take a spot up there on the grassy knoll was just much too casual. This thing was all planned in an extremely thorough and meticulous fashion. In fact, it even appears there were gunshot sounds from Dealey Plaza reported the night before, Stan. I believe they were actually rehearsing in Dealey Plaza what they were going to do the following day. But one of the features that's interesting about James Files' report is he describes this experimental new Remington high-velocity anti-varmint weapon that fired approximately 22 caliber or 22.223 caliber slug that it was an exploding bullet. Now, that kind of bullet could have been used because, as I described before, that bullet in Enerjack's right temple was an exploding or frangible bullet. And it's not inconceivable to me that the weapon he describes, this Remington fireball, it is known as, could have been used in the assassination. But what Files doesn't say, in my opinion, excludes him from actually having been a participant. Most importantly, he does not describe the limousine as having been brought to a halt. But we have established through a lot of different evidence that indeed it was brought to a halt. So if Files doesn't report that, in my opinion, he cannot have been there.
Well, you know, there's so many books that have been put out, and I'm sure many of them are written by very, very sincere people. And then my impression is that some of these are simply CIA plants. In fact, I'm always very, very suspicious when somebody tells me they've been a CIA agent, and now they're going to just blow the war, CIA operative usually, and now they're going to tell the true story.
Yeah.
And have you run into that?
I mean, yes.
Traveling?
Yeah, there's a guy named Robert Morrow who published a book called First Person Knowledge, where he said he was in the CIA, and he was responsible for getting a whole bunch of these Mannlicher Carcanos.
Right.
And distributing them, but you know, that's like saying a whole bunch. You get enough counterfeit money together, you're going to have real bucks. I mean, those were such junk weapons that I don't care how many Mannlicher Carcanos you had, they weren't going to be useful in perpetrating an assassination of this caliber. The assassins, I believe, were using their preferred weapons. You know, it's a kind of a personal relationship between a shooter and his rifle. And I think several different calibers were involved in this assassination, and that's one reason why the body may have been messed with between Parkland and Bethesda. There was an effort to take those slugs, the pieces of lead of different caliber, out of the body, because as soon as you had two different calibers, it would have been so obvious that there had to have been at least two different assassins. In fact, the shots that Jack sustained that were widely reported the day of the assassination were both shots fired from in front. The shot to the throat, for example, was reported by Malcolm Perry, who performed the tracheostomy in a vain effort to save the president's life, where he made an incision right through this small, round, neat wound in the throat. And during a press conference that began at 3:16, he three different times described that wound as a wound of entry. A reporter said, was it coming at him? He said, yeah, it was coming at him. Was it an entry wound? Yes, it was an entry wound. Where was the entry wound? It was in his throat, and so forth. Plus, the shot to the head that blew out the back of his skull and blew out his brains was also described as having entered in the right temple. In fact, when the president's death was initially announced by Malcolm Kilduff, who was the acting press secretary, Pierre Salinger was aboard a plane with most of the members of the cabinet on their way to Japan, and Malcolm Kilduff was substituting for him in Parkland. When he announced the president's death at around 1:30, he said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head and pointed to his right temple, attributing that description to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. And if you watch the television footage for later that day, you find that they are gradually getting their story of what happened to the president, and they described two wounds on television that day, the shot to the throat and the shot to the right temple, both of which were fired from in front. In fact, this was so widely broadcast that Robert B. Livingston, M.D., the world authority on the human brain, who I have mentioned, concluded that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs of the National Archives couldn't be the brain of Jack Kennedy, actually was in Boston when he heard these radio reports. Now, he was at the time the scientific director of the National Institute for Mental Health and the National Institute for Neurological Diseases and Blindness, which is located in the building for the National Institutes of Health, which is located across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital. So when he got home from Boston, when he flew back home, he lived in an area very near to the hospital, and he decided to call over there to tell the physician who was going to prepare to conduct the autopsy about what he had heard about the wounds, because he had supervised an emergency medical hospital for injured Okinawans and Japanese prisoners of war during the Battle of Okinawa, so he's also an expert on wound ballistics. He called over, and the officer of the day put him through to Commander Humes, and they had a conversation during which Bob Livingston explained to Commander Humes, who said he wasn't paying attention to the reports in preparing for the autopsy, and Bob Livingston explained to him that there was a description of a wound to the throat that had to be a wound of entry, and therefore, and this is so ironic in retrospect, if there was any evidence of shots from behind, then there had to have been at least two assassins and therefore a conspiracy. And about this point in the conversation, they were interrupted by the Secret Service, who wouldn't allow them to talk any longer, or it may have been the FBI. Bob describes it in Assassination Science, which he found quite curious that these government officials would be interfering with the physicians in a discussion about the forthcoming autopsy of the President of the United States.
Well, we're going to take another 3 minutes, and get yourself a little something to drink or get up and stretch. We'll be right back. And this is the time, once again, when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon you for what we do, and that is trying to get the truth out across America. And it's really amazing that we are on 5 hours a day, and but I will tell you, it's terribly expensive. We go behind every month, but we would appreciate if you believe in what we're doing and you'd like to become part of our team. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, so those people who join the Radio Liberty family of supporters get our 4 best tapes of the month. They get our monthly newsletter. But more than that, of course, they have our appreciation for their help, and because it's that allows us to do what we do. And we send our newsletter to opinion makers across the country. And I will tell you that many of them read it, and I will get calls from them from time to time saying, hey, what's the reference on that? Or, I really like that idea. Now, how can we prove that? And, of course, we provide them the information, because I'm not about to put out a newsletter that I can't back up with responsible information that I really believe is valid. So that gives us an opportunity to magnify many times over our influence, because if we can reach people who can reach the large numbers of people across America, we can make a difference. And when you become part of our team, you become part of that difference. So we hope many of you will decide tonight, and especially now, because I believe I've been at this for 39 years. As Sonny was saying, he's been listening to me for a long time. And, of course, we need help to do what we do and then to progressively expand our coverage as long as we're allowed to, and as long as God gives us me the health to continue doing what I'm doing. So remember the number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we want you to go to our website, and specifically we wanted you to tell other people about our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can pull down our newsletter. In fact, we encourage you to, if you do not subscribe or belong to the Radio Liberty family of supporters, pull down the newsletter and, of course, get that out across the country. Now, you'll find a few of the things I've written up there on the Georgia Guidestones. You'll find the things on population control. We don't have time to do much else besides turn out a newsletter every month. But I'll tell you that newsletter has good information in it. Go back to the earlier newsletters, and you'll find things about the world movement, about history, about Plato and Socrates, and about Pythagoras and Alexander the Great and Aristotle, things that you'll never find anywhere else, because they were all tied into a movement. And, of course, these movements have been around since the inception of history, but, of course, they are coming to their fruition this very day. So remember again the telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Remember, of course, our website, www.radioliberty.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. Truly, more than ever before, America is under siege today. Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is a professor. He's a philosophy teacher. Now, that's a long way from being a Marine. How did you ever get to be a philosophy teacher?
Well, as I would say, you know, if you're in the Marine Corps, you got to be philosophical, Stan. you're right. I was an unusual combination. I wanted to go into the Marine Corps because I figured if I was going to be in a military organization, I wanted to be in a real one, and that offered me that opportunity. It was a great experience, but I also knew I didn't want to spend my career in the Corps, and that going back to graduate school, I had a debate between going to law school and going on in philosophy, and it became very clear during those years as I sorted things out that philosophy was the route I wanted to take. I might mention for some of your listeners, Stan, some Texas connections in relation to the assassination.
Right ahead.
Some things they may not know. For example, Billy Saul Estes, who was involved in some grain scandals that involved a lot of friends of Lyndon Johnson and probably Lyndon himself, eventually led to the murder of an agriculture inspector who came out there to try to find the grain against which the government had issued huge loans, and the grain, in fact, did not exist. He gave an interview about 2 years ago to a French investigative reporter by the name of William Raymond, in which he explained that LBJ had sent his chief administrative aide, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure that all the arrangements for the assassination were in place. Now, that may sound startling to some of your listeners, but we have other corroboration of LBJ having advanced knowledge of the assassination and being intimately involved. For example, he had a lot of affairs. He used to boast that he'd had more women by accident than Jack Kennedy had on purpose, and I'm willing to believe that that was true. But one of them was a long-term relationship he had with a woman by the name of Madeline Duncan Brown, an affair that began in 1948 and issued in the birth of a son in 1950, a young man named Stephen, who was not Johnson's only child out of wedlock, but was his only male offspring. Stephen lived till 1990, when he died of bone marrow cancer. But among the information we get from Madeline Brown, who's published a book about her relationship with LBJ, but with whom I've had over 100 conversations, Madeline explains that the night before the assassination, there was a social event at the home of Clint Murchison, who was one of the really powerful oil men in Texas at the time. And that was attended by an unusual assortment of heavy hitters, including J. Edgar Hoover, who used to visit Dallas frequently as the guest to Clint Murchison. Madeline said when she came out there that evening, she thought maybe this was in honor of Hoover, but he wasn't the only heavy hitter there. John J. McCloy from Chase Manhattan Bank, who'd been our former high commissioner to Germany, was also there. Later on, when LBJ created the Warren Commission, he would put John J. McCloy and Alan Dulles on the commission as the two, quote, civilian members, end quote. But, of course, they both had very long ties to the government and were hardly independent or civilian, as that slot presumably was intended to be. Richard Nixon was there. He was driven out by a local Republican figure with whom Madeline worked in a bank building downtown where she was a young advertising executive. H.L. Hunt, another oil millionaire, was out there, and of course Hunt really thought of himself as the richest man in the world. Madeline tells stories about encountering Hunt, for example, out in the parking lot behind the bank when he was distributing some of these posters that were attacking Jack Kennedy. And Madeline said, "Why, H.L., you can't do that." And H.L. said, "Oh, yes, I can." He said, "I'm the richest man in the world. I can do anything I want." Well, these guys were all there when Madeline said late into the evening, just about the time the party was about to break up, LBJ arrived. This was very surprising. No one expected to see him there. And all these heavy hitters disappeared into a conference room where they remained for 15 or 20 minutes. Now, when it broke up, LBJ strode over to her, and she expected he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. But instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. Now, that rather took her aback, and in fact, the next day, the next morning, he called and gave the same message, that after that day he wasn't going to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. She wouldn't see him until 6 weeks later, when they had a rendezvous on New Year's Eve at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas. And during that rendezvous, Madeline confronted Lyndon with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved in the assassination, since no one stood to gain more personally. She said that Lyndon just blew up at her and got really angry and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. Now, Madeline and I have discussed this many times, and I'm quite convinced of her sincerity. She's the real deal. And I'm convinced this gives us some insight that we can't get from any other source about the origin of the assassination and what it was really all about. these people in Texas, Dallas at the time, really thought that they were the ones in control of the government. Hoover, of course, had a special arrogance, and as you have reported already, hated the Kennedys. He thought they were completely immoral. Of course, he used his dossiers on the sex lives of prominent politicians, including the Kennedys, to force them to conform as a form of extortion, to conform to policies or to act in ways that he would prefer that they might not. And Hoover being out there is very telling, in my opinion. And I think this meeting at the Murchison's home was a ratification meeting, finally giving a green light to going ahead with the assassination, and Madeline just circumstantially happened to be there.
I think that's a fascinating part of this. But, of course, the CIA had to be deeply involved to have, you know, because they're all the people who witnessed one thing or another. I think there was Dorothy Kilgallen. She was investigating this. And,
oh, yeah.
Oh, there were, you know, well, Craig Roberts has written a book on the missing witnesses. And at the end of 30 years, there were 100 and some odd of these people who had actually witnessed one or another thing that was going on. Somebody had witnessed the shooting of Officer Tippett, and, you know, over 100 of them had died under very serious circumstances. I don't know, it was about 15 or 18 of them with a year or two.
So, well, yeah.
Somebody was simply rubbing out people who knew too much.
Well, I mentioned the book by Robert Groden, The Killing of a President, which is a collection of the most important photographs that is being offered, you know, in this bargain package with Murder in Dealey Plaza on Amazon.com. In that book, Robert Groden has pale yellow panels that are about 2x4 vertical panels, in which each one of which he describes one of these mysterious deaths, so they're distributed throughout the book. So you actually get quite a bit of information about individuals who were close to the assassination, may have been witnesses, or who knew too much, who died very strange or mysterious deaths. You mentioned Dorothy Kilgallen. Of course, she was the only reporter who actually had a private interview with Jack Ruby. She, I think, learned a lot from Ruby. Ruby said some very interesting and important things in public, but he may well have said other extremely important things in private. Dorothy Kilgallen, unfortunately, let it be known. She told others she was going to blow the whole case wide open, and the next thing we know, she's dead of a drug overdose. Apparently, she did have a tendency to use drugs, but she knew so much about drugs that she just wouldn't be a person who'd be inclined to give herself an overdose. And within a few weeks' time, within less than 2 months, her closest friend, in whom she might have been expected to confide, also died a mysterious death. And, of course, all of the notes and records she had about the case just disappeared. Among the things that Ruby said, by the way, Stan, that was so fascinating, one was, he said, the whole thing was bizarre if you knew the individuals and groups involved. And if we're talking about a conspiracy that brought together the CIA with the mafia, with Texas oilmen, with the vice president of the United States, with the director of the FBI, you certainly have a bizarre assortment of individuals. He said that their motives were very tangible, very palpable, very down to earth. And if you consider the CIA did not want to be shattered into 1,000 pieces, as Jack was promising to do, but wanted to retain its power to exercise its control around the world, that the mob wanted to regain those resorts and casinos and get Bobby off their back, that Hoover wanted to remain as director of the CIA, that Lyndon wanted to become president of the United States, and the oilmen wanted to preserve their oil depletion allowance, which Jack was threatening to cut, then you realize that he might be exactly right. They were doing this for roughly business or very mundane reasons that are very obvious once you understand them. And finally, he said, a whole new form of government was going to take over the country. And, of course, if the occupancy of the presidency is being determined at the end of a rifle barrel, we do have a whole new form of government. And I do think the consequences of that assassination remain with us to this day.
Well, of course, then we had Bobby, and then we had, of course, Martin Luther King. And, you know, but we've had so many other things that have gone on. And as long as they can keep getting away with it, they're going to keep getting away with it. That's the difficulty. And I do not think we'd be in the mess we are today, you know, already facing an outbreak of terrorism across America, the imposition of a police state to counter the terrorism that is going to result directly from the holy war that we are creating. And I believe we're not creating it because we're stupid. I believe that this is part of a very intentional thing, but none of these things would happen if we truly had honest representatives in Washington, D.C., an honest media. And, of course, I believe that there's no way they could have pulled this thing off had it not been for a media that represses and suppresses the truth. And a perfect example is when you put on that large press conference and it was just totally ignored by the media.
Here's a good one, Stan, you're going to appreciate. This was an article from the New York Times on 24 March of this year, 2001. CIA sought to control Bay of Pigs news. And it's talking about how during the invasion and before and after, the CIA was managing the national news, the stories that were being reported. And the agency said, after these disclosures, get this, Stan, this is a stunning paragraph from the New York Times. The agency said after the disclosures that it would not manipulate the American news media except in the most dire national emergencies, and it reaffirmed that policy several times in the 1990s. Now just imagine, except in the most dire national emergencies, but of course the CIA is going to decide which emergencies are dire national emergencies that they should be entitled to manipulate the nation's news. I mean, I was just astounded that this would appear in our newspaper of record, because, of course, the New York Times is the official history of the United States as it's recorded in newspapers, and there not be a national outrage over the CIA admitting openly that it manipulates the nation's news. But there it is.
Well, you know, I had the opportunity one time to talk to a major who had been in charge of the war room at the Pentagon on the leading up to the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he told me that the target for the invasion was not the Bay of Pigs. They were going to go ashore another place. And if they actually, of course, if they, you know, fail, they could go up in the Sierra Maestri. They might not be the best equipped, but then neither was Castro's people when he was there. But the one place that they would be sure to lose was the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
And the reason for it was because there was this intense thicket behind it. They call it the swamp, but it was something that was totally impenetrable. You got on the beach, there was no place to go except up the road, and there were 5,000 Cuban troops sitting there waiting for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole, as he said, you know, when we realized they changed the landing, we knew those boys were sent in to fail, and we knew they were being betrayed, and he said, we all went out and got drunk.
Yeah.
And, of course, 20 years later, I was going to do some filming. I called him, I still had his address, and I tracked him down, and he checked with the Army of Intelligence, and they said, oh, no, if you were to tell the story now, it might embarrass some of our operatives. In the name of military intelligence, because you were an intelligence officer, you cannot have permission to put this story out officially. So, you know, it's cover-up, cover-up, cover-up.
Yeah, I know. What's this embarrassment business? I mean, the American people can handle the truth. We just need to know what the truth is. And if our government doesn't tell us, it's like the fact, Stan, that we have the CIA conducting all these covert operations around the world, committing murder, assassination, terrorism, torture, destabilizing governments, and the American people aren't told what they're doing. Well, if we're not told what we're doing, we don't even know what our foreign policy is. How can we know if we support it? I mean, it's just fundamentally incompatible with democratic government.
Well, of course, I don't really think we have a representative government. I think that we have an elite. They have an agenda. And, of course, I disagree violently with that agenda. Right now, we've got somebody I think you know, Bruce Adamson, calling in from Aptos, who I think is the world's leading authority on George de Morenschild. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Fine.
I've gotten a couple emails from Jim, I think, in the past here.
Yes, we have, Bruce. Good to talk with you.
I've never heard you speak, but it sounds like you know a lot about it. You didn't get into de Morenschild, but I guess you knew everybody at that Trent Murchison party.
I got to say, I love your stuff, you know. I think it's really fascinating, and the connections you draw between de Morenschild and the Bushes, I think, are extremely important. I wish the whole world were aware of it.
That was kind of what I figured I'd tie it into what you were just talking about, is a lot of people don't know is that George Bush was a partner with Edwin Pauly in Permaco Oil Company, Mexico City, which was the headquarters for the CIA's Operation Zapata, which was the Bay of Pigs invasion. And I spoke to Edwin Pauly's daughter-in-law, and she told me that Edwin Pauly called her 3 days before the invasion and told her that if anything should go wrong, that their bomb shelter would be fully supplied.
This was the Bay of Pigs invasion?
That's right.
Right.
Just to lend a little more background to that, as Craig Roberts has pointed out to me, and possibly to you too, Stan, the code name, as Bruce is observing, for the Bay of Pigs invasion was Operation Zapata, which happened to be the name of the Bush family oil drilling operation.
Company.
My conjecture, by the way, is that if the operation had been successful, that the Bush company would have gone to contract for oil drilling all over the Caribbean basin. Two of the ships were rechristened just before the invasion. One was rechristened Barbara, and the other was rechristened Houston. I think you see George Herbert Walker Bush's fingerprints all over this case. I've even discovered a photograph in Jesse Curry's book, JFK Assassination File, published in 1969, that shows a person with a certain posture, with his hands in his pockets, standing in a characteristic way with just that boyish look that I believe is George Herbert Walker Bush standing directly in front of the book depository building on the day of the assassination. When he became the director of the CIA, of course, it was widely claimed at the time that this was the first time a civilian who'd never been an operative or had anything to do with the agency was made the director, but that seems to be complete malarkey for public relation purposes. For example, there are documents that show that a George Bush of the CIA was being briefed on the operation as it was going down. The agency, when asked this, said it was another George Bush, and there was another George Bush, George William Bush, but when he was tracked down, he said he worked in a completely different area, had nothing to do with it. He was only with the agency for a year. And it appears very clear that it was George Herbert Walker Bush. In fact, there are a couple of articles that were written in The Nation magazine about this that are republished in Mark Lane's book, Plausible Denial, about George Herbert Walker Bush's role with the agency. And later, when he became president, when in the wake of the great interest generated by Oliver Stone's film JFK, a law was proposed through Congress to release all of these files that had been kept locked up secret for 50 or 75 years. George Bush opposed it. He fought like mad to have that law not passed. And after the law did pass, after his strenuous opposition, he refused to appoint the five civilian members to the board, which had to await the Clinton administration. And of course, it took them a while for them to get their act together. And when they finally made the appointment, 18 months had passed in the meanwhile. The board, nevertheless, did do quite a commendable job in spite of the resistance by many of those bureaucracies that were able to outweigh it, and did release 60,000 documents and records, which have made a difference and impact in our research in relation to the articles and studies that are published in Murder in Dealey Plaza.
I just make one point, and then I'll let Bruce comment. But, I think it's so interesting that Des Moineselt, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler, in other words, this was the man who was controlling him, more or less, was very close to George Herbert Walker Bush. What was the connection there, Bruce?
Bush wrote me a letter, which I constantly keep up on eBay under my user ID and website, CIAJFK.com. In 92, he wrote to me saying that he had known George DeMarchal since 1942 because he went to Andover with DeMarchal's step-nephew, Edward Gordon Hooker. Edward Gordon Hooker is a cousin to Mrs. One of the Rockefellers, Blanchette Hooker, who married, wasn't Nelson Rockefeller, but one of the other Rockefellers. That slips my mind right up this moment.
One's Lawrence. And,
I just can't get it right at
this point. Don't worry about it. We won't hold that. But basically, what was the direct tie other than the fact that Bush wrote you a letter saying he knew De Moineselt, but wasn't his telephone number in De Moineselt's
address book? Yeah, 1954-55, his nickname, Poppy, and Bush's Zapata Oil Company is listed in De Moineselt's phone book. And then De Moineselt, while the Bay of Pigs are training down in Nicaragua, De Moineselt stumbles onto their training camp in Guatemala City with his donkey. He's on a 3,000-mile donkey trip with his wife and Countess the donkey and Nero the little dachshund riding on the back of the donkey. And De Moineselt just happens to stumble onto the CIA's training camp for the Cubans who are going to invade the Bay of Pigs, which The Barbara J was one of the boats.
Now that's you're suggesting it was named after Barbara Bush.
No. A lot of people have, and another person involved was Howard Burris, whose wife was Barbara Jester, the daughter of the governor of Texas.
Okay. But
Barbara Jean was Edwin Pauley's wife's name, and Edwin Pauley was George Bush's oil partner in Permago Oil in 1961.
Pauley at the time was a publisher of the Time Life, was he not?
No, Edwin Pauley is the chairman of the Democratic Party of California. Pauley Pavilion, and he had an island, Coconut Island, in Hawaii, in a direct line to the White House for Truman all the way up to LBJ.
You know, there's several books out now, Bruce, that suggest that Bush had something to do with the use of drugs, you know, in the CIA, which seems to have been a big drug distributor. He started to say during an interview the other day how when you're dealing with these unsavory characters, they want money, and he said, and other things. And you could just see he was suppressing the use of the word drugs because he didn't want to admit that the CIA has been big in dealing drugs. But do you think it's possible that this nickname had to do with his involvement in the drug trade and opium and poppy?
Well, I never thought about it, but that's a good point. But I will mention that the drug smuggler Barry Seal, who was trained by the same guy who trained Oswald, David Ferry, threatened George Bush Sr., and 10 days later he was assassinated. I have the actual picture on my website. But on his possession is Vice President George Bush's telephone number.
Yeah.
And then when George W. Bush took over as governor of Texas, guess who inherits Barry Seal's airplane?
Who?
The governor of Texas.
Okay. Well, there's so many connections here, and you've done a great, great job of putting them all together. But unfortunately, we're running
out of time.
Bruce,
we're set for the 10th, though, right?
We are set for the 10th, and I'll look forward to it.
Are you on the Internet, just so I can let people know? Can they listen real audio?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's at radioliberty.com. It's www.radioliberty.com, and please encourage them, and this program is going out on the Internet as well.
Good to hear you, Jim. Nice to talk to you.
Real pleasure.
Thanks so much for calling, Bruce. Bye-bye. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting comments or thoughts? I know you have a lot of them, as being a philosopher.
Well, Stan, I'd just like to compliment you. I think you've been doing a tremendous job in maintaining this radio connection with the American people. I think that you have, you're a man of principle, and you certainly know a tremendous amount about the assassination. I'd just like to say, if anyone out there wants to know more about my work and those with whom I collaborate, I also have a website, www.assassinationscience.com, www.assassinationscience.com, where they can learn more about our books and our research, and you'll find critiques of work of those who are spreading disinformation, such as Gerald Posner with his book Case Closed, but where he was recently featured on the Today Show of all things. And Katie Couric, I'm afraid, was just taken right in by Posner and all of his oily charm. But if you want to find out what happened in that program, I have posted there a study about the disinformation, even from the Today Show, and lots of other stuff. So,
well, I think that the real message for today is that we have to learn from yesterday. We have to learn what happened then and see how this coordinated effort was able to confuse, and a lot of it's just planned confusion. So you get so much disinformation, you finally just say, I can't figure it out, and you give up.
Stan, you know, you put your finger on it. That's really the objective. Gayton Fonzi, who was the chief investigator for the House Select Committee when it reinvestigated the case in 77-78, published a book called The Last Investigation. And on the last couple of pages, he's quoting a psychiatrist who's observing that the point of all this is to leave us in a state of uncertainty where anything can be believed and nothing can be known. Now, the purpose of our research is to try to take rumor and speculation out of the assassination and place its study on an objective and scientific basis, which I believe Assassination Science and Murder in Dealey Plaza admirably accomplished. But if the American people don't know how much we know, how much we actually know, they may be left in a state of uncertainty that only works to the advantage of those who would deceive us, mislead us, and corrupt our way of life.
And still trying to confuse and deceive us even this 38 years after the assassination.
Yes.
And so anyway, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating 2 hours, and God bless you for everything you do. I hope maybe we can get you on one of our other programs, because, as I say, we have what a unique opportunity to talk all to these different audiences, and, of course, they're all hungry for truth, and I think the truth is so important today. Without it, we're going to lose America.
My great pleasure, Stan. I commend you for your program.
Good night. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this program as much as I've enjoyed it. And, of course, there's just so many unanswered questions out there. Our producer was simply asking the question, you know, how is it that the FBI, within just a couple of days of the attack on the World Trade Center, was able to come up with pictures of all those people involved? I don't know how long it was, but, you know, they've had those pictures for quite some time. Wasn't that an amazing, amazing feat, considering they're all dead and incinerated? But then, of course, there's so many other answered questions. And so we want to tell you, please pray for America. Our country's in real trouble. And if America falls, the world will go back to the dark ages. And then we ask you to pray for our leaders, and yes, even pray for George Bush. And we ask you, of course, to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision, our protection. We'll be back tomorrow evening at the end of the week with another fascinating program. Until then, may the Lord be with you.